which is, of course, code for F Joe Biden. It's one of the cringiest new right wing phrases, which they think is super clever. And it's not. I wouldn't go to such a restaurant if I ever saw that at the bottom of a receipt. I would never go back. Everybody's got to decide for themselves what to do. Last one coming in via Twitter. This user says, David Pakman, you seem to suffer from a pretty severe case of autism that has only intensified over the years. It's hilarious that you'd call anyone a doofus, referring to the judge in the Rittenhouse case. It's hilarious that you'd call anyone a doofus. How hard were you bullied growing up? Or were you just socially awkward to the point of becoming socially crippled? Very, very big shot across the bow. Of course, if anybody knew about my first jobs, which I've talked about here on the show, which were very, very much sales oriented, dependent on rapidly reading social cues and building rapport with people you've just met, you might come away with a different conclusion. But a very interesting response here to me saying that Rittenhouse judge was wacky, wasn't he? So congratulations to everybody who got their messages into the mailbag today. You can write in info@davidpakman.com. You might notice all of the emails that get on are one paragraph. So the multi-page emails, as much time as may have gone into them, which we appreciate very much, they're not going to make it onto the mailbag. And we have a fantastic bonus show coming up for you today. Sign up at joinpakman.com. You will get access to the bonus show instantly, as well as the commercial-free audio and video feeds.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh, yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
WRCT in sound from way out. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Four precious children were killed in yet another case of senseless violence in our schools. Tonight, we remember their names: Hannah, Justin, Madison, and Tate.
Funerals in Oxford, Michigan have begun for the four students killed in last week's school massacre. On Friday, the parents of the 15-year-old shooter were arrested after a manhunt. We'll speak to the head of the gun control group, Brady, as well as a mother who lost her 6-year-old son 9 years ago in the 2012 Sandy Hook School massacre in Connecticut. Then, killer robots. The Biden administration's rejected calls for an international ban on the use of lethal autonomous weapons.
Killer robots will pose an existential threat to humankind. They must be preemptively prohibited. They should never come into existence. Killer robots will be morally, ethically, and legally unacceptable. Life and death decisions should not be delegated to machines. There should always be meaningful human control over the use of force.
Plus, we look at how the Pentagon covered up a massacre in Syria, where a secretive U.S. Special Operations unit killed dozens of women and children in an airstrike. We'll also look at drone strikes in Yemen. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Omicron coronavirus variants continuing to spread around the world, with cases detected in nearly 50 countries and nearly one-third of U.S. states. Omicron's proliferation has led dozens of nations to impose new travel restrictions. Beginning today, all international travelers entering the United States will have to take a coronavirus test 24 hours within their departure or prove that they've recovered from COVID-19 in the last 90 days. It's still unknown whether Omicron poses more risk than earlier forms of the coronavirus, but top U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci said Sunday there are early indications it doesn't lead to more severe disease. The World Health Organization has so far not reported any deaths linked to the new variant. It's unknown if Omicron will overtake Delta, the highly transmissible variant which now accounts for most of the world's infections. Here in the U.S., COVID-19 hospitalizations continue to rise in a post-Thanksgiving holiday surge with an average of nearly 110,000 infections reported each day. Another series of demonstrations against COVID restrictions took place over the weekend, including a rally of 40,000 people in Vienna, Austria, where a lockdown is starting today, and vaccinations are set to become mandatory in February. In Belgium, protesters clashed with police in Brussels as they marched towards the EU headquarters. Demonstrations also took place in Spain, Germany, the Netherlands, and Australia. In Germany, outgoing Chancellor Angela Merkel used her final video podcast as the country's leader to urge residents to get vaccinated amidst a fourth COVID wave.
Nehmen Sie das tückische Virus ernst.
Take the malicious virus seriously. Right now, the new Omicron variant seems to be more infectious than the previous ones. Get yourself vaccinated. It doesn't matter if it is a first shot or a booster. Every vaccine helps.
Germany is essentially banning unvaccinated people from public life. In Jordan, a court sentenced 5 senior health officials to 3 years in prison Sunday over the deaths of 10 COVID patients after a state hospital experienced an oxygen shortage in March. The deaths triggered anti-government protests across Jordan. In the United States, the parents of the suspected Michigan high school shooter are being held on a bond of $500,000 each after they were arrested on Saturday after a manhunt in a Detroit warehouse. James and Jennifer Crumbly pleaded not guilty to charges of involuntary manslaughter over last Tuesday's mass shooting, which killed four students and wounded seven other students and staff at Oxford High School. Their 15-year-old son was charged last week with terrorism, murder, and other counts. James Crumbly and his son went to buy the gun used in the massacre just days beforehand, and both parents are accused of giving their son access to a firearm, even as he displayed obvious signs he was thinking about committing violent crimes, and he was only 15 years old. In Burma, a court sentenced deposed civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi to 4 years in prison. She's accused of incitement and violating COVID rules, which have been blasted by rights groups as fabricated charges aimed at suppressing opposition. It's the first verdict of the nearly dozen charges leveled against Aung San Suu Kyi by the military junta, which overthrew her government in a February 1st coup. The Biden administration is expected to announce a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Beijing Winter Olympics. The move would mean U.S. athletes will still compete, but no U.S. officials will attend the Games and is intended to send a signal over human rights abuses in China. It also would come amidst growing concerns for star tennis player Peng Shuai, whose social media post revealing her sexual assault by a former vice premier was censored, and who some say is being coerced by the Chinese government. In Indonesia, at least 15 people are dead and over two dozen are missing after Mount Semeru, one of the island nation's most active volcanoes, erupted Saturday, spewing blistering hot ash and volcanic ash into the sky over the East Java province. Some 3,000 homes, dozens of schools have been damaged. Over 1,700 people have been evacuated. Rescue operations were suspended today as Mount Semeru continues to spew hot clouds of ash. In India, a funeral was held for the 15 civilians killed by security forces in the northeastern border state of Nagaland over the weekend. The majority of the killings happened on Saturday after security forces say they mistook a group of mine workers for armed fighters. More people were killed in ensuing protests. The state's chief minister is demanding the Indian government repeal a contested law which allows security forces to kill with impunity in parts of India. Pope Francis returned to the Greek island of Lesbos this weekend to visit a refugee camp and call on the international community to respond to the ongoing humanitarian crisis of forced displacement, which he called a shipwreck of civilization. Pope Francis, who visited Lesbos in 2016, lamented that little has changed since then as he spoke with refugees at a refugee camp which holds about 2,300 people.
It is easy to stir up public opinion by instilling fear of others. Yet why do we fail to speak with equal vehemence about the exploitation of the poor, about seldom mentioned but often well-financed wars, about economic agreements where the people have to pay, about covert deals to traffic in arms, favoring the proliferation of the arms trade? The remote causes should be attacked, not the poor people who pay the consequences or are even used for political propaganda.
Voters in The Gambia have re-elected Adama Barrow as president of the small West African nation. It was The Gambia's first election since former president Yahya Jammeh fled into exile in 2017, 22 years after he seized power in a bloodless coup. Jammeh had refused to accept Barrow's previous win and was forced from power by a military alliance of other West African states. In South Africa, about 1,000 people took to a beach near Port Edward Sunday, protesting plans by Royal Dutch Shell to do seismic oil exploration in the eastern seaboard's wild coast, which environmentalists say will threaten pristine wildlife refuges. The action took place after a South African court Friday rejected an application filed by several advocates, including local fishermen and Greenpeace Africa, to stop the exploration of petroleum systems in the region. This is a fisherman at Sunday's protest.
I don't think this is helping the economy, but just bringing destruction. Here we can swim and do other things, but if Shell is coming here, I don't think we'll ever access this place.
In Serbia, thousands of protesters blocked major roads and bridges in the capital, Belgrade, and in other cities and towns Saturday in opposition to a government-backed plan allowing the Rio Tinto Corporation to build a massive lithium mine. Protesters said they've had enough of widespread pollution and are demanding clean air, water, and food in Serbia.
Of course, we go out into the streets. The environment is the most important political question. It is not right that young people stay out of politics. Politics is everything that surrounds us, and the environment in particular. So we are against Rio Tinto and all other corporations of the sort.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot dead a 16-year-old Palestinian after he allegedly drove his car into a military checkpoint. The teen was identified as Mohammed Nadal Yunus. This comes as human rights advocates are condemning the killing of a Palestinian man shot dead by Israeli police after he stabbed an Israeli settler in occupied East Jerusalem. Al Jazeera reports footage by bystanders shows police continuing to shoot Mohammed Salima from point-blank range even after the 25-year-old had been knocked to the ground and no longer appeared to pose a threat. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin are scheduled to speak via video call Tuesday amidst mounting tension over the military buildup at the Russia-Ukraine border. The U.S. and other Ukrainian allies have warned Russia could soon launch an offensive, with U.S. intelligence warning last week the Kremlin could deploy as many as 175,000 troops early next year. Russia has rejected claims of an invasion and accused NATO and others of escalating the situation. Moscow's warned of consequences if Ukraine joins NATO. In Chile, environmental advocates are demanding justice for Javier Rojas, a 42-year-old land defender who was found dead in a late November in the northern Chilean region of Antofagasta. Rojas's body was discovered in an empty home buried underneath a pile of clothes. Her hands and feet were bound. Her body had multiple wounds. She was well known for leading protests against a thermoelectric project in northern Chile. In 2016, she was involved in a campaign that successfully canceled a dam that would have stolen water from local communities and harmed wildlife. Two men, including Rojas's partner, were placed under arrest while her death is investigated. CNN fired star anchor Chris Cuomo Saturday, just 4 days after the cable network suspended him indefinitely amidst revelations he helped his brother, disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, respond to accusations of sexual misconduct. One day after his suspension last week, a lawyer told CNN about another allegation of sexual misconduct against Chris Cuomo. The accusation was made by a former colleague, though it's not clear if that played a role in his firing. In September, Chris Cuomo's former boss at ABC News, Shelley Ross, revealed he once touched her inappropriately at a public gathering. In Washington, D.C., over 100 masked white supremacists from the Patriot Front paraded in front of the Lincoln Memorial and on the National Mall Saturday evening. The demonstrators wore matching blue jackets, white neck gaiters, brown boots and hats, and khaki pants similar to those worn by far-right protesters in 2017's deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. They held shields, upside-down U.S. flags, and a banner that said, "Reclaim America." Bystanders booed as the leader of the hate group gave a speech. Over two dozen participants reportedly found themselves stranded after the bizarre display when their ride, a rented U-Haul truck, was not able to fit all of them inside. And former Senator and Republican presidential contender Bob Dole has died at the age of 96 after a struggle with lung cancer. Dole served four terms in the House of Representatives before Kansas voters sent him to the Senate in 1969. He served 3 years as Senate Majority Leader before resigning in 1996 to unsuccessfully challenge then-President Bill Clinton's re-election. In April of 1990, Dole led a congressional delegation to visit Saddam Hussein in Baghdad. Later that year, Iraq invaded Kuwait. Dole would go on to support both the 91 U.S.-led assault on Iraq and the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. He attended the 2016 Republican National Convention, telling USA Today, quote, "I'm a Trumper." He also supported Trump's 2020 reelection campaign. President Biden called him a friend and ordered flags to be flown at half staff through Thursday in honor of Bob Dole. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The funerals have begun in Oxford, Michigan, for the four students killed last week when one of their 15-year-old classmates opened fire in a rampage that also injured six other students and a teacher. The school shooting occurred shortly after the gunman was allowed to return to class after a meeting with school administrators and his parents over concerns he might commit violence. The student has been charged with terrorism and first-degree murder. Authorities have also charged his parents, James and Jennifer Crumbly, with involuntary manslaughter. They were arrested Friday after a dramatic manhunt. They were arrested hiding inside an artist studio in a Detroit warehouse over the weekend. James Crumbly and his son went to buy the gun used in the massacre just days beforehand, and both parents are accused of giving their son access to a firearm, even as he displayed obvious signs he was thinking about committing violent crimes. Republicans have responded to the school shooting by refusing to pass new gun control measures. On Thursday, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley blocked a bill to expand background checks for gun purchases. He claimed the bill was, quote, hostile toward lawful gun owners and lawful firearms transactions. Meanwhile, Republican Congressmember Thomas Massie of Kentucky is facing widespread criticism after sharing his family's holiday photo, which shows Massie and his family brandishing military-style rifles in front of a Christmas tree. Massie tweeted the photo Saturday, just 4 days after the Michigan school massacre. He included a caption reading, "Merry Christmas. P.S. Santa, please bring ammo." We're joined now by two guests. Nicole Hockley is the co-founder and CEO of Sandy Hook Promise. Nicole is the mother of six-year-old Dylan, a first grader killed in the 2012 mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School almost 9 years ago. Chris Brown is also with us, an attorney and the president of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence prevention organizations in the country. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. Now, I wanted to begin with Chris Brady, with Chris Brown of Brady. You have a situation now where you have a pro-gun control president who's a Democrat. Both houses, the Senate and the House, are Democratic and have a majority of gun control Congress members and senators. And you have the NRA at its weakest point ever. How is it possible that they cannot get gun control legislation passed? And what kind of gun control legislation do you think is necessary at this point?
I think it's a very good question. Look, we have an epidemic of gun violence in this country. We lose 40,000 Americans a year. More than 80,000 more are shot. And the tragedy in Michigan just drives home the incredible personal toll that gun violence is taking on too many families across this country. Congress needs to pass a broad array of policies. We need to enforce the law better, and we have to reemphasize the importance of responsible gun ownership in this country. But to answer your question, yes, we have a majority, a gun violence majority in the House.
Gun control majority.
A gun violence prevention majority in the House. The Senate has a rule called the filibuster. And that rule is killing us. You need 60 votes to get cloture in the Senate, and we don't have, unfortunately, a 60-vote majority around gun violence prevention. That's why we need to end the filibuster if we're going to get common-sense laws like the Brady law expansion that Senator Grassley held back for reasons that defy any sense of logic through and save lives.
Nicole Hockley, I can't even bear to go to you. It is so painful. Your loss in 9 years ago next week, losing your little boy in the Sandy Hook massacre. How old would he have been today?
He would be 15 now, but unfortunately he will forever be six because that's when he was killed.
And so I'm going to put the same question to you. I mean, you had what? 20 children killed almost 9 years ago at Sandy Hook. Do you see any progress? And if you could respond to everything you saw unfold in Michigan, with now the parents of the shooter being charged, which is unusual with involuntary manslaughter, they had bought him this gun, his father, the day after Thanksgiving. And when they had the school meeting the day that he opened fire in his school, hours before, his parents said they wanted him in class. They didn't tell the administrators, not clear that the administrators asked, that he had a gun or he had access to a gun, not clear they knew it was in his backpack. And this horrifying text from his mother to him, LOL, I'm not mad at you. The only problem is you got caught, when talking about the teachers turning him in for looking for ammunition on his phone and having pictures of a bloodied body and expressing real alienation and horror, talking about his own pain.
This is a horrible example of activity that happens all too often in America right now. And that's why at Sandy Hook Promise, we teach children and the adults around them across the country in schools, how do you recognize the warning signs of someone who's at risk of hurting themselves and someone else? And how do you take action and intervene? And I think between what the parents did, there's potentially a system-wide failure here when we look at what the investigation is going to be showing and what might come to light. But it is just heartbreaking to know that this was an absolutely preventable act of violence. This was a child that clearly needed help, that clearly should not have had access to deadly firearms, that clearly should not have been in school that day. And what he was posting on social media was enough to scare other students from not going to school that day. I think much more action should have been taken. And certainly the parents, this is not something that you take lightly. We need everyone to take these warning signs seriously and to act immediately, because this is how tragedies happen. And that is unfortunately exactly what we saw in Michigan, with significant loss of life and irreparable physical and mental health challenges now that will affect that community forever.
How do you think they could have stopped this, Nicole?
Where do I start? They could have stopped this when he first started displaying warning signs. They could have stopped this by not allowing access for a 15-year-old to have access to a firearm of this nature. They could have stopped by searching him, by asking, do you have your gun on you? Searching the backpack, taking him out of school, getting him the help that the school was recommending that he get. And I also, you know, I have an issue with, I understand that there's a strong gun culture in America, and I respect responsible gun owners who keep their firearms safely stored, with the ammunition kept separately. This was evidently not the case, because the boy was able to access the firearm and take it to school. And for parents, you know, this can be a bonding exercise. I understand that between family members. However, when a child is clearly showing behavioral issues, perhaps there are better choices than bonding over firearms.
It is astounding that on Tuesday, a teacher found on Ethan Crumbly's phone a drawing that showed a semi-automatic handgun pointing at the words, "The thoughts won't stop. Help me."
Yes. That's a cry for help. This is a boy who needed help, who was on a plan of action to hurt himself or hurt others. He chose to hurt others. But that is a very overt warning sign. That is a threat. And that should have been taken very seriously, and immediate action to ensure that he was not able to go forward with his plans.
And they didn't have to figure out if it was a threat. It was a drawing of a bullet with the words "blood everywhere" written above it. Between the drawing of the gun and the bullet is a person who seems to have been shot twice and is bleeding, said the prosecutor.
Yes. Yes, that's a blatant threat. There's a lot of threats that are much more covert and hidden, and sometimes you just have to react to your gut reaction that something's not right here, that someone needs help. But what that shooter was displaying were incredibly overt signs of imminent violence, and that's what makes this even more heartbreaking and unconscionable.
So, Chris Brown, it is just astounding to fathom 100 people killed from guns a day in this country, with what, another 230 shot and wounded. We have, the massacres that take place in the schools, the number is also just astounding. No country in the world experiences something like that. Can you talk about the U.S. Policy on guns and how alone it is?
I can tell you the U.S. policy on guns is much more lax than any other industrialized country. And we also experience far more gun violence than any other industrialized country. And when we look at the 100 individuals a day on average who are dying, the 200 plus additional who are injured and live with the trauma of those injuries for the rest of their lives, it's really unconscionable that we're not taking more action to address the issue. Because as Nicole is saying, in many circumstances, not just a few, gun violence is entirely preventable. We need stronger policies. We need to ensure that before any gun is sold in this country, a Brady background check is done. And that's the bill pending in the Congress right now. That's one example of what we have to do. We have to have a director of the ATF. Joe Biden put one forward that was quashed by the NRA with senators doing their bidding. David Chipman would have been one of the best directors in ATF history. Why do we need that? Because the ATF hasn't had a permanent director in decades in the position, and the enforcement function that they perform to protect Americans across this country is huge. And finally, we need to focus on responsible storage of guns in home. We have more than 400 million guns in this country, more guns than people across this country. 5 million kids are in homes today with loaded, unsecured guns. And we see the impact of that, not just in school shootings. 75% of school shooters get their gun from a home where there's not safe storage, but also in the rising rates of suicide across this country, especially with teens, and the 8 kids a day who are killed or injured with guns in their own home. We have to take this seriously and actually move forward as a society, move forward with laws, move forward with enforcement to save our fellow citizens.
I want to turn to a crucial gun rights case last month. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a lawsuit brought by an NRA-affiliated group called New York State Rifle and Pistol Association. They argue New York State has gun restrictions that violate the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court ruling could have ramifications for gun control for the entire country. This is Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito asking about illegal firearms on the subway in New York City.
Armed people on the streets of New York and in the subways late at night right now, aren't there?
I don't know that there are a lot of armed people.
No?
There are people with illegal guns.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. How many illegal guns were seized by the New York Police Department last year? Do you have any idea?
I don't have that number, but I'm sure it's a substantial number.
But the people, all these people with illegal guns, they're on the subway. They're walking around the streets. But the ordinary, hardworking, law-abiding people I mentioned, no, they can't be armed.
So that's New York Solicitor General Barbara Underwood being questioned by Justice Samuel Alito. Chris Brown, talk about the significance of this and the NRA. I mean, it has the issues of bankruptcy, the issues of corruption at its lowest ebb, and yet still Democrats and Republicans alike cower. Just the thought that they would take aim at them, which clearly it doesn't look like they can at this point?
It's a very good question. Look, the NRA built its reputation, led by Wayne LaPierre. There was a struggle for power at the NRA in the 1970s, and unfortunately for all Americans, Wayne LaPierre won. And ever since that time, he's been promoting really a guns everywhere view of the Second Amendment. And Justice Alito's questioning is the logical following of that false notion about the Second Amendment. Look, in the colonies themselves, there were many laws. In fact, the historical precedent is set forth in all of the amicus briefs for the kinds of regulations that existed with respect to storage of guns in homes and with respect to carrying guns in public places, where it was assumed that the state, that the government, had an interest in protecting public safety by ensuring that not just anyone could carry a gun anywhere at any time. And that's what's at stake with this case. It's about a century-old permitting system for the state of New York that just stands for the proposition that individuals carrying guns in public should state a reason, a good reason, and that the state can review that and object to it if they do not have a good reason to be carrying a gun in public. And so it's very concerning because the precedent of this decision could mean that permitting systems across this country are overturned that restrict who, when, and how individuals can carry guns in public. And I can tell you, as someone out in public, often, too often, in states that do not have strong permitting systems, it is extremely concerning to be standing next to someone getting ready to speak when they have an AR-15 fully loaded, strapped on them. That's not an America I think any of us want.
Finally, Nicole Hockley, can you tell us about Dylan? Next week will mark the 9th anniversary of the Sandy Hook massacre. And if you could tell us about Sandy Hook Promise running the anonymous reporting system called Say Something for classmates of troubled people.
Sure. Well, thank you for asking about my son. I have two children, and they are both the loves of my life. Dylan was murdered in his first grade classroom, and he is the reason that I have helped launch Sandy Hook Promise and work hard to create a safer future for my surviving son, but also for all children, because I think that's what they deserve. And they do not deserve to be shot down in their classrooms, of course, or live in fear of shootings in their schools or homes or communities. What we do at Sandy Hook Promise is we very much work with organizations like Brady to support gun safety and mental health legislation, to enforce behaviors and provide appropriate access and responsibility. But what we're also doing on the ground is behavioral change. We go to schools and we train students and the adults around them how to recognize warning signs. One of the ways that they can report those warning signs is through the Say Something Anonymous reporting system. All of our programs are provided at no cost to schools nationally. For the anonymous reporting system itself, we currently are in about 5,000 schools, reaching about 2 million students, so that then if they see a warning sign or a disturbing behavior, whether it be about violence or self-harm or substance abuse or dating violence, they can submit a tip, and our 24/7, 365 trained crisis counselors triage that tip and work it with local school teams and local law enforcement, whether it's a life safety or a non-life safety event, to ensure that action is taken and help is given. We have averted countless suicides and also multiple school shooting plots. So this is the work that I do to honor the son that I lost that was murdered at Sandy Hook, and for all the children that survive, and to help try to bring about a safer future for them.
Well, Nicole Hockley, I want to thank you so much for being with us, co-founder of Sandy Hook Promise, mother of six-year-old Dylan, a first grader killed in the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre, and Chris Brown, attorney and president of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence prevention organizations in the country, named for Jim Brady, who was shot in the head in the assassination attempt against President Reagan. He was the press secretary for Reagan. Next up, we look at how the Pentagon covered up a massacre in Syria, where a secretive U.S. Special Operations unit killed dozens of women and children in an airstrike. Stay with us.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone. I wonder if she's gonna stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away. And I know, 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 I know.
Ain't No Sunshine by Bill Withers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has ordered a new high-level inquiry into one of the deadliest known U.S. airstrikes in recent years. In March 2019, a secretive U.S. Special Operations unit called Task Force 9 bombed the Syrian town of Baghouz, killing dozens of women and children. The bombing came as the U.S. was attacking one of the last strongholds of the Islamic State in Syria. The military then spent 2.5 years covering up the attack, even though the high civilian death toll was almost immediately apparent to military officials. One legal officer even flagged the attack as a possible war crime. U.S. military officials downplayed the death toll, delayed reports, and sanitized and classified evidence of civilian deaths. U.S.-led coalition forces also bulldozed the blast site. The Pentagon reopened its investigation only after the New York Times exposed what happened. This comes as U.S. Central Command acknowledged Sunday that civilians may also have been killed last week when a U.S. drone strike targeted an alleged al-Qaeda leader. We're joined right now by Priyanka Mothaparty, director of the Project on Armed Conflict, Counterterrorism, and Human Rights at Columbia Law School. She recently co-wrote a letter to Defense Secretary Austin calling on him to review the civilian death toll of U.S. airstrikes in Yemen in light of the military cover-up in Syria. Professor, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Why don't we start off with Syria? I mean, what it took to get this official investigation. Explain exactly what you understand happened in March of 2019.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Amy. So what we understand at this point really comes from the New York Times reporting. And what they reported is that in March 2019, 70 individuals in Baghouz, Syria, were killed, a large number of them women and children. Immediately after that airstrike, it was reported by at least one Air Force lawyer as a potential war crime. And yet in the period between then and now, it seems like every effort to investigate this strike, to report it up the chain, to have very serious review happen of what occurred in this strike, of why these women and children were killed, to determine their status and whether or not this was a war crime, it seems like at every step, these investigations failed, the efforts to report them failed, the efforts to draw attention to this very serious incident have failed. And so where we stand now is that the Pentagon has ordered yet another investigation into this incident. But what we really need to see is, you know, for this investigation to be credible, for it to be meaningful in any way, it will have to be different from any investigation we've seen at this point, whether that is into what happened in Syria or really any investigation they've carried out elsewhere as well.
I mean, in addition to everything else, the bulldozing of the site of the attack in March 2019, can you respond to this? And also, the Pentagon spokesperson, John Kirby, saying no military in the world works as hard as we do to avoid civilian casualties. Start off with the bulldozing of the site, clearly to destroy the evidence.
Of course. So, first of all, the bulldozing of the site is just one piece of a larger puzzle where, again, every aspect of what was supposed to happen failed. The site was bulldozed. Records were apparently, strike logs were apparently falsified or, you know, incorrectly registered. The strike was reported, but no serious investigation happened. This is not the case of one little mistake, one extraordinary incident, one unique case where one thing went wrong. This really points to a crisis of accountability in the Pentagon. And you see that by the fact that, as you said, the strike was bulldozed. That was happening on the ground, in the control room. You know, the reporting did not go as it should have gone. In terms of the record keeping, that also did not go the way it was meant to go, and the way we're told it goes. We are told, as you said, that this military does more than any other military in the world to avoid civilian casualties, to prevent civilian casualties. And yet that, and again and again, that is not what we see. We continue to see civilians getting killed. Investigations, thorough investigations, are not happening. And that is a key part of what needs to happen. How can you say that your military is doing more than any other military in the world when you're not doing the basic elements needed to properly investigate what happens, why civilians are getting killed, and taking the basic steps to ensure that it doesn't happen again? If you are not properly investigating these types of incidents, then you are not able to make the corrections you need to make to ensure that civilians don't get killed in the future. And that is why we are looking not just at what happened in Baghouz, but really, you know, a 20-year record of civilian harm that has happened in Syria, but also in places like Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, elsewhere.
And I want to talk about Yemen in a minute, but can you talk about this secretive U.S. Special Operations Unit called Task Force 9 that carried out this particular attack?
Really, Amy, what I know about Task Force 9, again, comes from that New York Times article. And what we found is that there was a real, you know, what we read from that article was that there was a real lack of coordination between that task force and other parts of CENTCOM that were operating in Syria in the exact same theater, in the exact same, you know, very small piece of land at that point in time. And, you know, what the New York Times reported about Task Force 9 raises some very serious questions. They reported that Task Force 9 repeatedly described its operations as self-defense operations, even when there was no incoming fire, even when their troops were not on the ground. And a number of other concerns as well were raised in that article. So certainly, you know, part of this investigation needs to be looking into what this particular task force was doing, not just in this one incident, but really in the variety of incidents, the variety of operations it was carrying out. Because it's very hard from reading this article. When I read this article, it was very hard to think this is an isolated problem. It does not appear to be an isolated problem because it's very hard to imagine these types of mistakes happening just as one-off incidents.
You mentioned other countries. Let's talk about Yemen. Late last month, the Saudi-led military coalition launched air raids on the capital, Sana'a, with reports of massive explosions in the city's northern neighborhoods. Saudi officials said they were targeting Houthi military sites in retaliation for the rebel group's earlier drone strikes on sites in Saudi Arabia, including a major oil hub in Jeddah. The latest violence coming after thousands of people marched through the streets of Sana'a protesting U.S. support for the Saudi-led military coalition.
We, the Yemeni people, took to the streets today to denounce the military escalation carried out by America, the economic blockade, and the continuation of aggression. We had thought that when Joe Biden took office, he would keep his promises on stopping the war in Yemen and open the airport in Sana'a. It turned out that all that talk was a lie.
Talk about what's happening in Yemen, Professor Priyanka Motaparti.
Of course. So the war in Yemen is in its seventh year. And let's remember that this is, first of all, there is the war that we are all familiar with, that we see, you know, daily in the news, which has caused the massive humanitarian crisis, which has caused thousands of civilian casualties, and where the U.S. has played a key role supporting the Saudi-led coalition. Support that, by the way, continues to this day and under this administration. Arms sales to Saudi Arabia continue. Counterterrorism partnerships with the Emirati government continue. There's really been no accountability for what has happened in Yemen, for the war crimes, potential war crimes committed by all parties to this conflict. And the U.S. has done, you know, in terms of the U.S. role there, the U.S. has played a very harmful role in supporting this conflict at the same time as it's trying to serve as a peace broker. So certainly the U.S. has a lot to do in terms of looking at the harmful nature of its support to the conflict in Yemen and really trying to rejigger what's happening there.
And the role overall of the U.S. in Yemen and who you think needs to engage in this investigation when we're talking about one of the world's worst humanitarian crises in the world.
Yes, of course. So first of all, the U.S. is, you know, supporting the Saudi-led military coalition. And let's also remember that the U.S. is carrying out its own military operations in Yemen, its own counterterrorism operations in Yemen, targeting what it describes as al-Qaeda targets, potential ISIS targets. And so there have also been civilians killed in those strikes that we have reported to the Pentagon. So the U.S. both has work to do looking at its role in supporting one aspect of the conflict, but it also has work to do examining and really being transparent about its role directly carrying out military operations in Yemen.
You mentioned Somalia. What most needs to be investigated there?
Again, you know, as in Afghanistan, as in Syria, as in Yemen, in Somalia as well, there have been many incidents where independent observers, journalists, and human rights groups have reported civilian deaths and civilian injuries, as well as other civilian harm in U.S. operations in Somalia. And again, we only see the U.S. admitting fault, acknowledging its role in causing civilian deaths, and just a very small fraction of these. There are a number of incidents that they've yet to take a serious look at. And we are not aware of any harm, any amends, any compensation being paid to families where they have acknowledged causing deaths, killing members of those families.
And Afghanistan, as you mentioned, I mean, we all now know about this drone attack in the last days of the U.S. During the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, because all the media was in Kabul. Would you say what we saw there and the admissions by the Pentagon because of the reporters on the ground interviewing the family and finding out the number of children who were killed, that this is an example of what's happened in Afghanistan for the last 20 years?
You know, that strike was in many ways of a piece with exactly what we've seen in Afghanistan for the last 20 years, where incorrect intelligence led to targeting and killing of civilians. In other cases, civilians have been killed as collateral damage. But either way, there has been, you know, a common response that these strikes were justified, that they were based on good intelligence, that they were, you know, righteous, as I believe one general said. In this case, what was unique is that, as you said, there were journalists in Kabul, excellent investigative journalists who went, who really followed this story up, who visited the family just, you know, shortly after that attack and was able to really piece together in a very detailed way not only who was killed and the fact that, you know, seven children were killed, some of them very, very young. But really pieced together the details of who this individual was, who was apparently targeted. He was a humanitarian aid worker, what he was doing the day that the strike was carried out. And to get a counter-narrative from the military in which they alleged he went to some kind of safe house and was packing his car with explosives. And what they were able to do was really contrast these narratives, one of, you know, supposition and assumption about his hostile intent, and one, the reality that he was an aid worker going about his days. And so what was unusual is that we were able to contrast these narratives and understand the truth of what happened in this case. But there are many, many other cases, families living in more remote areas, you know, whose harm did not happen in such a intense period where there was so much media scrutiny of what was happening in the country. And their cases, you know, did not get the same level of scrutiny, will not get the same response. And that is just a tragedy.
Finally, I want to ask you about the drone whistleblower, Daniel Hale. In July, the former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst was sentenced to 45 months in prison, almost 4 years in prison. He's pled guilty to leaking government documents revealing the U.S. military's drone program. In November 2013, he spoke at a drone summit in D.C. organized by Code Pink.
Before I begin, one last thing. I just would like to, in a way, say I'm sorry. I'm not up here for any good reasons. And to the people in the audience who are victims or who are families of victims or have families who live in countries where U.S. militarism and specifically unmanned systems are conducting kinetic strikes, I'm sorry because I'm up here because I was for a time, a short period of time during my military career as a an analyst working with unmanned systems deployed to Afghanistan. And at the very least, you all deserve an apology.
That's Daniel Hale, the drone whistleblower, now being held at a communication management unit in prison at United States Penitentiary Marion in southern Illinois. Professor Motaparti, who should be in jail and who should be free?
You know, I think that that question really, what we want to do is what we want to understand, you know, why Daniel Hale did what he did. What motivated him and what were the results of his actions? And frankly, what he did was to bring to the American public and to the global public a level of transparency about what was really happening in some of these drone strikes and, you know, the way that civilian casualties were being undercounted through the systems that the U.S. military was using. What he disclosed, among other things, was that, you know, individuals who were not identified, who were killed in these strikes, you know, people who were killed, whose identity was not known, they were also being described as enemies killed in action. And that is how we came, that is part of the reason that we consistently undercount, you know, the number of civilians killed in U.S. military operations overseas. And understand them to be, you know, more successful or more justified than they may be in reality. Daniel Hale played a key part in exposing that undercounting of civilian deaths. And certainly he did a great service to the American public in exposing that information.
Professor Priyanka Motaparti, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Project on Armed Conflict, Counterterrorism, and Human Rights at Columbia Law School. Next up, ahead of an international meeting on killer robots, the Biden administration rejects calls for an international ban on the use of lethal autonomous weapons. Stay with us. The main theme from Terminator 2, Judgment Day by Brad Fidel. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We end today's show looking at how human rights activists in some countries are calling for an all-out ban on the use of lethal autonomous weapons known as killer robots that can make the final order to kill without a human overseeing the process. They're coming under review during high-level talks on the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons next week. The Washington Post reports at least 30 countries have called for a ban on killer robots. Last Tuesday, New Zealand said it would join the international coalition demanding a ban, declaring, quote, the prospect of a future where the decision to take a human life is delegated to machines is abhorrent. But so far, the Biden administration's rejected calls to ban the use of killer robots. During a UN meeting in Geneva Thursday, the U.S. instead proposed establishing a code of conduct for their use. For more, we're joined by Steve Goose, director of Human Rights Watch's Arms Division and co-founder of the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. Steve, thanks so much for joining us again. First, explain what killer robots are, and then talk about the U.S. role in fighting the ban.
Yeah. Killer robots are a thing of the future, but they're not in the distant future. These are weapons that take the human out of the loop. That is, it is not the human who decides what to target and when to pull the trigger, but instead the weapon system itself does this through artificial intelligence and sensors and algorithms. This is not just a new weapon, it's a new form of warfare and not one that's going to be nice to humankind.
So explain who's developing them, who's using them and what the U.S. position is versus places like New Zealand and other countries?
There are a handful of countries that are very vigorously pursuing research and development programs aimed at the acquisition of killer robots or fully autonomous weapons. The U.S. is perhaps at the top of the list. Others would be Russia, Israel, South Korea, India. Those are the problem countries, but there are others. Most any advanced military is developing weapons that have ever greater amounts of autonomy in the systems. The question is, how far do you take that? Do you take it all the way till you remove the human from the loop altogether, or do you draw a line where there's still meaningful human control? For the U.S., their position is essentially one of wanting to safeguard their ability to produce these weapons. So they're rejecting any notion of a treaty that would have prohibitions or restrictions on the development and acquisition of fully autonomous weapons, and instead are proposing proposing measures that would allow the acquisition of the weapons, but have some regulations about how they're used.
So earlier this year, the New York Times published a piece on the use of an autonomous weapon to kill an Iranian nuclear scientist. Can you talk about that?
There's a lot of misunderstanding about what a killer robot might consist of and whether or not they exist today. Systems with a great deal of autonomy already exist. Indeed, drones have a great deal of autonomy. And you were just talking about drones a moment ago. But systems that remove the human from the loop altogether are what we're trying to oppose, and those do not yet exist.
And can you talk about the Geneva meeting that's taking place on certain conventional weapons? Explain its significance. And Human Rights Watch's recent report, Crunch Time on Killer Robots, existing international laws not adequate to address the urgent threats posed by such weapons that some countries are developing.
There are diplomatic talks that are going on this week, last week and this week, that are aimed at developing options for future work on what they like to call lethal autonomous weapon systems, or LAWS, a very unfortunate acronym for this issue. And these are preparing for a five-year review conference of this CCW, the Convention on Conventional Weapons, which will take place next week. And at this five-year review conference, they're supposed to look at what they've done over the past 5 years and plan for the next 5 years. And it's a decision that will have to be made about what to do on killer robots. And they're looking at the various options that are out there. The majority of countries want to see a legally binding instrument, a new treaty that would have prohibitions and regulations on fully autonomous weapons. Others are proposing a non-binding political declaration. Others are proposing a code of conduct. The problem with a code of conduct is that it presupposes that indeed you will pursue these weapons, they will come into being, and it'll be just a matter of how well you can regulate them. We think that is an approach that will result in these weapons proliferating around the world and having the destabilizing effect that is all too easy to imagine.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Steve Goose, director of Human Rights Watch's Arms Division and co-founder of the Campaign to Stop Killer Weapons. That does it for our show. We hope everyone will join us on Tuesday night, December 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, when we celebrate at democracynow.org our 25th anniversary. We'll be joined by the birthday boy, Noam Chomsky himself. That's right, December 7th will be his 93rd birthday. We'll also be joined by Angela Davis, Arundhati Roy, the National Book Award-winning poet, Martina Spada, Winona LaDuke, Danny DeVito, Danny Glover, and more. You can go to democracynow.org for details. That's December 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wearing a mask is an act of love.
RCT, the In Sound from Way Out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Susan Schnall about the new bill that has been introduced in the House of Representatives to provide compensation for victims of the U.S. spraying of Agent Orange during Vietnam.
Susan Schnall is an historic figure. She first came to our attention dropping anti-war leaflets on bases in California, and she's now very active trying to help people who are victims of Agent Orange.
We speak with National Lawyers Guild attorney Arthur Heitzer about the U.S. efforts to undermine the advances of the Cuban Revolution.
The U.S. government has been very active lately trying to do that, but they flopped on November 15th.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
This is co-host Jim Lafferty with an editorial. Don't blame the Rittenhouse jury. Don't blame the weak case put on by the prosecutor. And don't blame the behavior of the pro-Rittenhouse judge hearing the case. Hell, any honest juror sworn to render a verdict based upon the Wisconsin state law and the evidence presented in the trial really had little choice but to vote to acquit Rittenhouse. What the Rittenhouse verdict says about America is obvious and very disturbing. The first thing it says is that this is a country where 17-year-olds can legally acquire military-style rifles and carry them around in public. What the Rittenhouse verdict says about America is that it's okay to come to a protest by people you don't like and come to it heavily armed. The verdict says that in the city where the shootings took place, you and your AR-15 assault-style rifle will be greeted warmly by the cops on duty there. They will give you water to drink and thank you for showing up to support them. The verdict says that if the people protesting were understandably angry at you being there along with your AR-15 styled rifle and express their anger in such a way that you can later claim you felt threatened, that it was just fine, just self-defense on your part when you shot and killed two of the protesters and wounded a third. Never mind that Rittenhouse placed himself into the situation in the first place. Never mind that as a 17-year-old he was too immature to responsibly handle such a situation. Never mind that when he felt threatened, rather than go home or put down his gun, he chose to stay and kill people. And although, as I say, under the law governing the case, a not guilty verdict is understandable, the result is that Rittenhouse has killed people, and he's paid absolutely no price for doing so. In fact, he's already a hero on the right in America and will likely be rewarded with a great book deal. And what is the overall takeaway from the Rittenhouse case? It is that vigilantism is just fine in America because whatever else was true on the night Rittenhouse killed those two young men, he was a vigilante. America, of course, has a long history of vigilantism. The laws allowing white folks to track down and, if necessary, kill runaway slaves was a law of vigilantism. The too-many-to-count lynchings and brutal beatings of black people by white people were acts of vigilantism. The brutal goons hired by companies when their workers went on strike to organize a union who worked side by side with the local corrupt cops, yes, they too were vigilantes. And speaking of slaves and black people, how many of us doubt that if Kyle Rittenhouse had been a heavily armed young black man instead of a young white man, he would have been found guilty by that same.